Hey everyone, Ellie here. Up Against the Mob is my new cafe podcast. We're pleased to offer this exclusive bonus just for Cafe Insiders with me in conversation with my co-host from the Third Degree podcast, Safina Meklai.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to a bonus episode of Up Against the Mob, this time talking about episode 4 with Ellie Honig speaking to Jim Gagliano. Hi, Ellie.
Good to be back with you, Safina. This was a fun one. Jimmy G is quite a character, and he's got some stories to tell.
He was so fun to listen to. You two clearly have a great rapport. And speaking of rapport, I thought we could just jump right in. And Jim talks about going for runs and living with and building this great rapport with Sammy. And how did you do that? I assume you couldn't go on long jogs with your cooperators. So how did you get close to them?
No, I never could go on long jogs with cooperators. But, you know, it's like, I guess, any other human relationship where it only works if you're yourself. But, you know, who you are has to vary depending on the situation, right? Like, you're never going to be buddy-buddies with your cooperator, certainly right off the bat. And that's not the goal, right? The way we teach it, the way you're taught at the Southern District of New York and in any prosecutor's office that knows what it's doing is this is supposed to be a professional relationship. This is not a personal relationship, right? They even used to teach us, don't allow the cooperator to call you by your first name. It has to be Mr. Honig. Part of that was to establish the healthy distance. And part of that was because in the courtroom, you didn't want them going like, well, Ellie met with me a couple times because the jury's going to be like, oh, really? You guys are buddy-buddy like that? You know, you wanted it to be respectful. And that is the right way to do it. However, we are all human beings and you spend a hell of a lot of time with these people, especially, by the way, in the mob context where these cooperators would be with us for years. They would do 5, 6, a dozen cases. And so, you know, I knew some of these folks for years and years and years. And the setting changes too. This is important to understand. Most of your interactions with cooperators start in the office, right? They will come into what we call a proffer session, the first interview where they're handcuffed and the marshals walk them in and their defense lawyer's there and you're there and the FBI agent's there. And it's really like not that different from any other business meeting. I mean, you're talking about crimes with a cooperator, but you're sitting around a conference room table. As time goes on, however, these guys start to get to move to prisons and you go visit them at the prison. And I spent many long days alone in the prison visiting rooms with these guys. And what do? You bring a couple sandwiches because you're going to have to eat. And then these guys get out into the real world. Maybe they're in WITSEC, and so witness security program. And so you meet them and you spend a week with them in a residence in, I won't say the names of any towns, but some small town in, you know, some sparsely populated state. And you're together all day. And at some point you go, hey, the Yankees are on. Why don't we turn the game on? You know, keep it on mute. All right, fine. You know, how are your kids? And then you got to grab food. What are we going to do? Are we going to bring something in? Are we going to go grab something? You know, and you just develop these human relationships the way Jimmy G did with Sammy. You know, they cook together, they shadow box, they ran, all that stuff. I mean, I didn't do all of that. A lot of food stuff, as I talk about. I did, you know, that was a big bonding point. But it just happens. And, you know, there are obviously lines that you don't cross. I didn't like to talk with the cooperators about my family at all. But they, you know, they were always happy to talk about theirs. And actually, I found that was a good way to really build rapport and build trust. How are your kids? Are they holding up okay? How's your wife? You know, are they doing all right? I've always found that was a way to sort of help build the relationship as well. So, you know, look, this stuff isn't always by the books, right? It's easy to say you should just be in the conference room and this and that. But when you really dig in and really work with cooperators, you can't help it. You're going to have a relationship form.
It sounds like food and exercise were both keys, but also sports games and just chatting and being human beings together is just like, it's common sense in a way.
Yeah, it's kind of what you bond on. By the way, I love that you call it sports games. That shows how little you know. Can I tell you one? I'll tell you two quick things relatedly. So these guys are not supposed to tell us where they're located, right? Because if they're in the witness protection program and you have to meet with them, the way it works is you tell the marshals who run the program, hey, I'm going to need a meet with, let's say, Sammy Gravano, hypothetically. And they will say, fine, we will set up what's called a neutral site visit, which is a different obscure town where neither of you lives. And so they fly us in, the FBI and the prosecutor, and they fly the witness in to this third party site. So the mobsters, the cooperators are not supposed to tell you where they live. But two guys, both, I remember very clearly, said to me, one guy let slip that his new team that he watched and root for in the NFL was the Denver Broncos. And I was like, okay, I have a sense of where you may be now. And another guy said to me, famous, I can't say who it was, but he said, Mr. Honig, I know I'm not supposed to tell you where I live, but I'll just tell you, it's a lot of mountains and a lot of Mormons where I'm at. And I was like, okay, all right, it's not New Jersey. I have a guess. So anyway, but that's the kind of thing that again happens over time.
It's so funny. That just made me think, like, in our current Zoom environment, I wonder if any of that's actually gotten easier, or like there are, I'm sure, concerns with cybersecurity, but I wonder if those meetings over the last 2 years were taking place on a remote Zoom link somewhere as opposed to a conference room.
I haven't even thought about that. I mean, gosh. It would have made life, in some sense, so much easier rather than traveling out to the middle of nowhere, Kansas, and you know, having to stay at the Homewoods Inn for 2 weeks to just hop on a Zoom. Gosh, I wonder if they do that. I mean, you're right, there's security concerns, but if they could address those, that would make life so much easier for everybody involved. So I don't know, I'll have to ask a current prosecutor if they do that.
Yeah, and it brings up kind of the debate that I think a lot of us have been having over the last 2 years can you build a relationship, a human, deep social connection on Zoom the same way that you can in person? Because, you know, on Zoom, you're not getting a meal with somebody, buying them a sandwich, or going on a run.
I was just going to say exactly that. Like, I guess I would have liked it for convenience sake, but, you can see the rapport that I have with some of these cooperators, both through my telling of it and through listening to me and Michael Visconti together. And you can tell from Jimmy, the way he talks about how he built a relationship with Sammy. And that's an important part of this business. And I don't say so because, like, oh, you need to like each other. You know, because, look, you always remember what these people did. And Jimmy talks about it. Like, look, as much as I had moments where I got along with Sammy, he killed 19 people, or he was part of 19 murders. However, it does help with that relationship of trust. And obviously, we have to trust them, the cooperator. And as I talk about, that's more than just, do I trust this person? That's, can I back him up? But they have to trust you, because they are taking this leap of faith in their lives, and their lives are never going to be the same. And they're endangering themselves and changing everything for their families. And Michael Visconti talks about this. He said something like, I was a maybe until I met you, because I was able to earn his trust and his confidence. And I think that's probably much harder to do over a Zoom than it was in that diner that Michael and I talk about, or over, you know, whatever Jimmy was cooking up with Sammy. So yeah, I do think that would be lost.
That is one of those skills, I think, that's involved in being a lawyer that's often not taught in law school. But so much of it is about building human relationships with your clients, with your witnesses, all of those people.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a way to teach that in law school. And law schools probably would not be particularly good at teaching it. But it's why being a lawyer is so much more than just the academic piece of it, or the knowing the names of cases and that kind of thing. So there is a real human element to it, especially of being a prosecutor.
Well, in the episode, Jim talks about being a rookie or a new kid and getting out of FBI training. And then he said that he got sort of a tremendous amount of responsibility right away. And you guys talk about those kind of initial assignments that he had, which seemed to me like huge assignments. And I'm wondering, having just graduated from law school, did you have a moment like that when you were a rookie at SDNY or new to the office? And what was your early time like?
Yes, all the time. Now, look, I never had anything remotely as extreme as, you're the brand new guy, here's the most valuable, most endangered resource in the country, you've got to guard him, right? I didn't have that. But one of the great things about being a prosecutor is you get so much responsibility so quickly. I remember very, very early on, I didn't know what to do with a case. And I had been at a big law firm for 3.5 years and had a great experience at that law firm and got what was considered to be a lot of experience hands-on for somebody at a law firm. And I go to the SDNY and I had this question, and I went to my unit chief and I said, what do I do on this case? And he said, well, call the defense lawyer and tell him this, and then call the judge's chambers and see if you can. And I was thinking, like, I can do that? Like, you'd be fired at a law firm if you, like, called opposing counsel and called a judge, right? You would have to, like, go through 8 different more senior lawyers, and you would never call the judge and the opposing counsel. Someone who'd been there 30 years would do that. And I love that about the SDNY. I mean, you know, the great part is, like, as someone said to me, we throw you in the deep end, but we don't let you drown. I mean, you are in court right away. I did a Second Circuit argument, a court of appeals argument the end of my first Friday in the office.
Whoa.
So I was there 5 days. Now, it wasn't a full case. It was a bail argument, an appeal of a bail case. So those are, but you know, I was standing up arguing in a federal court of appeals 5 days into the job.
Were you nervous?
Oh my God, I was beyond nervous. I was like, I can't believe I didn't pass out. You know, you always have a supervisor there, that kind of thing, but you're trying cases really quickly. And the pace of it, the pace with which you get given responsibility is one of the great things about being a prosecutor and an FBI agent. Like I said, I mean, you know, you FBI agents get put on these big cases right away. I always liked it when I had a brand new FBI agent put on a case of mine. I mean, it wouldn't be, you know, as the only agent on the case, but it was always fun to sort of watch them learn the process as well and help bring them along too.
Well, seeing as I'm starting a new job soon, it's good to, I like the metaphor that I'll be swimming in the deep end, but I won't be allowed to drown.
Yeah, and don't just pick up the phone and call the opposing lawyer or the judge. Run that by the partner or whatever. I don't want you to get in trouble at your firm.
Thank you. Will do. Well, did you ever have a story like the one that Jim tells where he talks about he heard about these cases on the news and then once he started with the FBI, it felt surreal that he was able to work on these cases? Did you have any moments like that?
I mean, I guess with the mob stuff in general, right? Just doing these mob cases, as we've talked about during this show, throughout this show, that it's so much of it feels like movie and feels like TV stuff. I mean, I certainly knew who the Gottis were since the time I was, you know, could ever remember. And I end up prosecuting John Gotti Jr. That was sort of, you know, that was a surreal feeling. But another thing that would happen all the time at the SDNY is I would see my colleagues make cases, and then those cases would become movies or TV shows. And it was like the reverse, I guess. Like, right. So just off the top of my head, when I was at the office, my friends, my pals, did the case with the Somalian pirate, which became the movie with Tom Hanks, right? Captain, whatever it's called. Captain Phillips, yes, exactly. That was a case that we did in the office, not me, but my colleagues. We did a case with Russian spies that became the TV show The Americans, right? I mean, the Bernie Madoff thing became a TV show. You know, you see things as they happen, and then a year or two later, you watch them become TV and movies. That is surreal. That's the opposite experience, but that's even more surreal.
That would be super surreal. And I think I would be obsessed with and worried about who would play me in a fictionalized version of a case that I was working on.
Absolutely. Well, we had that with Billions, right? Which is based on the SDNY. And, you know, I mean, Preet has talked about this, but the producers and I think the actor, I think Paul Giamatti, who plays the U.S. attorney, they shadowed Preet for a couple weeks and followed him around and saw what his day was like. So I can't say that the Paul Giamatti character is exactly like Preet in all respects.
They're definitely not twins.
Yeah, yeah. Not in appearance and also not in demeanor. But the show, I think, from what I hear, did a pretty good job of capturing. You know, it's obviously vastly sensationalized, but they seem to understand what it's like in some respect to be a prosecutor at the SDNY.
It must be both interesting and frustrating to watch some of the creative liberties that are taken, both with
oh gosh,
the office, the like personalities, but also the law. All of that must be just, it must be fascinating to watch that translated to Hollywood.
There was a trailer that they were running constantly for some new FBI show or something on one of the major networks. And it was one of these things that was constantly on it. And it was like, the tagline was like, the actor who plays the FBI agent goes, "I'm an FBI agent. I get shot at every day." And my wife's a federal prosecutor too, used to always look at each other and go, "I don't know a single FBI agent who's ever been shot at once." I mean, not to say that it's never happened. It has happened, and you know, but it's very, very, very rare. And you have this, "Oh, I get shot at every day." It's like, you're doing something wrong if you're getting shot at every day.
You're really bad at your job if that's what's happening to you.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Like I think the U.S. Attorney's Office is going to need to have a word with you because you're creating a lot of unnecessary shootings if you're getting shot at every day. But no, it definitely is hard for me to watch some of these shows. Like, that would never happen. Come on. It's kind of fun. It makes me feel smart.
Something that I think happens in movies a lot, and it seems happens in real life, is that you'll have this sort of notorious mob boss, and Jim talks about John Gotti Sr., who manages to avoid prosecution, despite that everyone knows that they're committing crimes. Did you have somebody like that? Somebody who you thought or you knew had committed a crime but always seemed to get away?
So I guess the short answer to that would be every mobster we didn't prosecute, right? Because the thing that's so bizarre about the mob, that's unique about the mob, is it's their job to commit crimes. There's no mobster who doesn't commit a crime. You would never get in. You would never survive in the mob if you didn't commit crimes. And so, you know, there's this theoretical argument out there about, well, you should never look for the person in law enforcement in general. You should never start with the person and then look for the crime. You should always start with the crime and then look for the person. And, you know, generally speaking, that's true. But in the mob, I argue, and I got into an argument with Murray Richman, who on his radio show the other day, Murray, of course, was our guest in an earlier episode. I did his radio show about just this. And I said, in the mob, I disagree, right? Because we know definitionally they are criminals. That's what they do. And so I think it's perfectly fine to say, hey, this person is rising up through the ranks. This person is now the boss. This person is becoming a more and more powerful capo and his crew is growing. What do we have on him? What can we find that he has done? What crimes is he involved in? Let's try to find the crimes that the person has committed. And we do that in the mob. And I think it's perfectly okay to do that with mobsters. So, you know that every mobster is committing crimes. You can't prosecute them all, right? There's way too many of them. And so you try to sort of, you know, pick your spots and go after the most important ones, the most powerful ones.
I imagine there's an element too of when someone is in the mob, it seems like there's like a flashiness to it. There's like an awareness that you all have that they're in the mob. So you know that there's something. So it's piecing together the crime and the person. And also the fact that it all feels quite public in some ways, too.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. You know, they barely put up any facade of having legitimate employment, right? It's laughably transparent what these guys claim to do. Most famously, I guess, or infamously, John Gotti Sr., when he was going through his court processing, claimed he was a plumber. But I had guys claiming that they were consultants became a big one. A strip club consultant was one guy. I don't know how that works. They all want to say that they're in unions or they're in trade or they're in imports. I mean, that's like cliche, but they do say that. But yeah, I mean, it's a ridiculous artifice. And our job is to pierce through that. And that was part of the fun, frankly. Like, you know, we knew they all were doing something. And it was just a question of like, can you find it? And, you know, most of the time we were able to, but not always. There were some guys we knew were involved in a lot of stuff and we just didn't have, you don't always have the proof. Like there's an important difference as a prosecutor between knowing something and being able to prove it. And that would happen. There were certain very powerful bosses that were elusive that we knew were committing crimes. We even knew sort of what the crimes were. But if you don't have the right cooperator and you haven't caught them on a wiretap and you haven't gotten lucky, you're not going to have the goods and you have to just move on to somebody who you can prosecute.
I do think sometimes that frustrates people who hear about sort of the distance between knowing something and proving it. But of course, it protects people in our system and it's the way it was intended to work. So even when it can be frustrating, you can see sort of another case where that burden really protects somebody from being falsely associated, maybe not in the mob, but just because of who they are with some crime.
It's true. And you see it happen in public life a lot. And not to inject politics into this, but a lot of times you hear with respect to Donald Trump, people say, oh, of course he was committing crimes. Come on. Of course he knew about what was happening at the Trump board. Obviously, he's the boss. He's Donald Trump. How could he not? But that's not enough, right? It's not enough for prosecutors. You can't stand in front of a jury and say, come on, people, get real. He had to have known. You have to be able to prove it. You have to have some piece of concrete admissible evidence. And I felt the same way a lot of times with these mob bosses. I would look at them and think, of course he knows that the family is involved in massive extortion of the construction industry. Of course he knows the family has taken over 8 strip clubs in Queens. Of course he's getting a piece of it. But you can't just stand in front of a jury and say, come on, folks, you know, we all know what's up here. You have to be able to prove it. And that's part of the challenge and can be frustrating.
I imagine a lot of the proving it comes with working together with prosecutors and law enforcement in this investigation phase to build the case. Something I'm really curious about is just what the relationship is like between prosecutors and law enforcement.
That is a great question. It's one of the most important and underrated relationships that you will have as a prosecutor, right? If you think about who does the prosecutor have to have good relationships with? Well, you think, of course, judges. You know, you have to be able to relate to a jury. You have to be able to deal with your defense lawyers. That's important, your victims. But boy, oh boy, to me, the most important relationship you can have that will determine your level of success as a prosecutor is with law enforcement agents. And that's for a couple reasons. One, you have to know how to work together to make a case, and I'll talk about that more in a second. Two is, people used to sometimes say to me, like, how do you end up with all these good cases on your desk? Like, how do they, it's like, they don't just fall on my desk. It's because I cultivate relationships with people like Jimmy G. I didn't know Jimmy when he was an agent and I was a prosecutor. I've come to know him since. But some of the guys that we talk about in the podcast, the guy who brought me Michael Visconti as a cooperator, other agents who I've talked about, you develop a relationship and they like you and they trust you, they're going to bring you the cases. They are the rainmakers. You know, they are the ones who bring it in the door. And so the relationship with agents is really important. And you have to sort of know and respect one another's role. Some prosecutors made the mistake of viewing it as a and B relationship, a subordinate and superior relationship, and would even use the phrase my agent, which I never used. I always tried to avoid using because it sounds like they work for you, which they don't. I always viewed, especially the investigative part, as something that had to be done cooperatively, right? I would say to the agents, what should we do? Should we pull their records? And the agents would go, well, let's pull this record now, and then maybe I'll go talk to this person. But it was always a we kind of thing, right? And that was the biggest sort of factor there, like working with them on the investigation, but ultimately knowing they're the ones who are going out serving the subpoenas. They're the ones who are going out doing the initial interviews, who are slapping handcuffs on people, and respecting that, right? And seeing that as equal to the work I was doing behind a desk. And I do see it that way, and I always did. And that led to very healthy relationships. Also, this is really difficult. There's a fine line between a lot of times the dynamic is the agent wants to be more aggressive. The agent wants to charge all 15 guys who we found in the room. And the agent wants to charge everyone with the max. And as a prosecutor, you can't be a wet blanket. You can't say, no, let's just charge the one easiest case. But you also can't like just want to be cool with the agent, go along with everything they want to do. You have to be able to say no. So my sort of rule of thumb was I was always responsive. I always got right back to the agents. I'd always talk to them. I'd always hear it out. I was probably on the more aggressive side of things in terms of charging, which they liked. But I was also able to say no. There were plenty of times when I said, no, look, we have enough on A, B, C, but we don't have enough on D or E. And they respected that. And at times they would want to debate it and I would debate it. But there's a fine line between providing good service to the case and to the agent and you know, being aggressive, but also pulling the brakes when necessary and saying, no, we don't quite have that. Or let's maybe start with these guys and then we'll see if we can get those guys. And the agents, if they, you know, as you build a relationship, come to respect that. So that is a really important relationship that I think sometimes goes overlooked. And by the way, I've seen prosecutors run into trouble with agents who either thought they were too timid in the way they approach cases, or who thought they were too condescending and sort of barked out orders to the agents, go do this, do that, do this, you know, my agent's going to do this, my agent's going to do that. So, you know, you really have to deal with agents as equals. I always did. It's the right way to do things, kids, when you become prosecutors.
I do feel like that's one relationship maybe Law and Order gets sort of right. I've definitely seen on TV that tension between agents or law enforcement wanting to go after everyone who is in a room, and the prosecutor in the room saying, I don't think it's feasible, or it's not right, or we can't do it, and that sort of tension. So I wonder if they get it right.
There was a phenomenon that we used to jokingly call the DEA plus one, which meant DEA was sort of notoriously very aggressive. And you would always go, all right, I'm going to sign this arrest warrant, and it's for these four people. And then you get a call from the DEA agent. They go, oh yeah, okay, we got all five. And you go, five? What do you mean? I thought it was four. And you go, oh, there was five people in the room. There was one extra. And so it's like, okay, all right, well, hold on a second. What's the evidence? You know, so you have to go through, okay, what's the evidence on that one person? If it was just, sometimes it'll just be like, well, he was in the room. You're like, okay, we're going to be cutting that person loose. But sometimes it'll be like, well, he was in the room and I found however many grams in his pockets. Like, okay, we're fine. So yeah, you have to know how to manage that relationship for sure.
Well, we're almost out of time, and I wanted to ask you one more question, which you talk a lot in this episode about the relationship between Jim and Sammy and just you all with your cooperators. And I wonder, did you ever fall in love, non-romantically, but just even as like a true, true friend with one of your cooperators?
Thank you for specifying that.
Either, I mean, you could answer romantically too if that ever happened, but I just guess.
Romantically, no. And non-romantically, probably, yeah. I think I would plead to that. In that, I developed a relationship that went beyond what the textbook says it should be. And I used to lecture within the SDNY on prosecutors. And one of my commandments that I would put up on the screen in my PowerPoint was, you may not fall in love with your cooperator. And of course, as I would always clarify, I mean that both in the romantic sense and the non-romantic sense. But yeah, I mean, look, did I develop a personal rapport with some of these guys? I mean, how can you listen to the Visconti episode and deny that? You know what I mean? And look, it's easier. I'm still in touch with some of them now because, you know, I care what happens to these guys. I want them to get their lives back on track. I want their families to be okay. You know, I was more circumspect about it when I was a prosecutor, but the truth is they develop an affection for you as well. I mean, I had cooperators who gave me gifts, nothing, you know, like one guy drew sketch drawings for me. One guy put together a cookbook for me from prison somehow. Again, it all just, for me, comes back to like, you're humans. And people approach this job differently. And I totally respect, it's probably better by the book to just never have any kind of relationships like this. But I don't know, it's just how I am. And it's just how things developed. And it always worked for me. And we got good results and fair results in court. So I stand by it. So I guess I'll plead guilty to violating my own rule there. Hey, the mobsters do it, I can do it.
Right, every code is meant to be broken, it seems.
Exactly.
Well, thanks so much, Ellie. This was a great episode and looking forward to discussing the next one next week.
Thanks, Davina. That's it for this episode of Up Against the Mob. If you like what you heard, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners to find the show. And as always, please send us your thoughts or questions to letters@cafe.com. Up Against the Mob is presented by Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm your host, Ellie Honig. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The technical director is David Tadashur. Music is by Nat Wiener. The Cafe team is Matt Billy, David Kurlander, Sam Ozerstaten, Noah Azulai, and Jake Kaplan. Special thanks to Nate White for his help with research. And special thanks to my interviewer, Safina Meklai. I'm Ellie Honig, and this is Up Against the Mob.